Hello, everybody, and welcome to the reality show. Sorry, the Daily Objective, day 178 of the war in Israel. Sorry for the delay. Tech issues were put on earth by God to delay podcasts, it seems. Daniel's good. You know that. He's always good. We're just going to launch straight into it since we were delayed.
Just
So,
quickly, did you say 77 or 78?
178.
It's 7.
Okay, 177. Excuse me. So, what we're talking about today is legal action which is being taken against the British government by a British Palestinian man for the suspension of funding for UNRWA by the UK government. Now, we're going to talk a bit about this and what we think about it. So, just some details or context for anyone who's not been following. UNRWA had its funding suspended in January by a huge amount of its supporters, one of whom was the UK government. A number of them have now reinstated their funding. So, if we're talking about Canada, the EU, Japan, and so on. Now, the British government had suspended its funding, which it had already paid for the year, which was about £35 million. UNRWA's budget was just over $1 billion a year. So, in pound, so the pounds converted to dollars, that makes about 44 million. So, it's about 4.4% of their budget. Not huge, but a notable part of it. And basically, the legal case is asserting that in having done so, the UK didn't follow proper procedure. And so that's what this case is about. It's going to be a judicial review looking at how that decision was reached. And part of the implication, and we're going to, and this ties into a lot of the coverage we've seen recently and a lot of the content we've been covering, is that in doing so, in having suspended UNRWA funding, the UK is contributing to the famine that's going on in Gaza. And therefore is possibly a party to genocide and in violation of the Geneva Convention. Particularly the man who seems to have launched the case. We don't particularly know many details about him, but his family is apparently in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza, which is supposed to be where the famine, you can look at our episode the other day where we had a look at those claims, is at its worst. So that seems to be what's motivating him. And I have to say that my first reaction to this is that the UK government is going to fight this and they're not going to reinstate their funding, although they've already paid it for this, the 2023 to 2024 year. Partly because Rishi Sunak, the leader of the government, the prime minister, is up for re-election later this year. And it isn't very likely to play well to his base if he were to do this. However, given the actions of the Foreign Office in recent months, granting asylum to a refugees to a guy who was claiming asylum refugee status from Israel on the grounds that Israel was an apartheid state, I have to say it's actually pretty up in the air, although that's my expectation. It's all to play for in the sense that they could well do this and they could well give in. So that's just some opening remarks. Daniel, what was your thoughts about this?
So something I should say. I'm not sure if we're gonna comment much on the legal aspects of this case. I mean, for all I know, the legal argument against the UK might be right. Maybe it was done wrongly or something like that. So I don't want to comment too much on that. I want to comment much more on, the aspects of the fact that, I mean, there's so many things to say, but I'm just gonna start with the main point because I'm going all over the place. So I named the episode "How the West Keeps UNRWA Alive," and the sort of the basic argument you could have for this title is the fact that UNRWA is largely funded by the West. But even when you ignore the financial aspects, I think the sort of moral aspects and the practical aspects on the ground is the way UK actually funds or the West actually supports the UNRWA. I mean, even in the article, it was mentioned that earlier this month, Cameron told the UK's House of Lords that UNRWA is the only body capable of delivering aid in Gaza. So you see, the people like David Cameron are fueling into this idea that, if UNRWA gets defunded, there's going to be a starvation in Gaza. There's going to be, a complete humanitarian disaster in Gaza, despite the fact that, and I think wrongly so, Israel lets an incredible amount of aid still into Gaza, mainly food. I mean, yeah, the case that there is a famine in Gaza, I mean, it's so overblown and it's so completely made up. I mean, recently I've read that the prices of food are actually going down in Gaza with the amount of aid that is being delivered there. And the only problem is that there is no one to redistribute it. So yeah, those are my first points. I have a couple more, but what do you think?
I think the key part here is the way that we're seeing the idea of genocide being fed in. Now, a lot of our content is focused on the way that the narrative is being built up, and this isn't the first time the narrative has been used against Israel. It's, at least looking back to 2014, if not further, you could say even all the way back to 1948, by the pro-Palestinian side, the idea that what Israel is embarking upon is a genocide or an incremental genocide, in Pape's term, has been very effective in being used against them. And the way these ideas end up getting used is that they're infectious, they spread out. So we're seeing here that the British government, in not giving their own money, the money of their own citizens, to this UN organization, which we have so many reasons and so much evidence to say is doing very, very much evil in this region, is not going to help. Its works are not going to help the people. It's actually going to perpetuate the conflict and to pervert the minds of the young. To its workers are ha helped in October 7th and are deeply mixed in with Hamas, with the terrorists. In not supporting this organization, our government, and by implication, you could even say me, are contributing to a genocide. Now that's completely farcical. And the idea that what Israel's doing anyway is a genocide is completely farcical. If Israel were wanting to do that, they could do it so much more brutally. And the death toll numbers which were coming out of Hamas would be so much higher than even the ones that they are reporting. And those, of course, aren't reliable, as we've looked at. But so the idea of genocide is being used again underhandedly and purely for the reasons of expediency, and is being used in all areas of this. So people just need to look and see that genocide is not only not a feasible claim, but it's got power to it because people are very much moved and understand that what genocide is very, very serious. It's being used in all areas of this argument. And for the British government, if they give in to this, not only have they already conceded grounds that Israel might be an apartheid state, but they would be admitting their own complicity in a genocide, and they would be confirming that, in their view, in their perception, that's what Israel is embarking upon. And we've already made the case that what they're doing is, in many of their actions and in many of the statements by David Cameron, is a brutal betrayal of an ally in its time of need. But if they were to give in, if they were to somehow view that this would help them in their electoral chances, or if they were to somehow lose the case, if the courts ruled against them. And so if they don't restore the funding by the 2nd of April, that's when the review will be launched. Then I don't know what leg this country has to stand on anymore in terms of its authority, its moral authority, and even the West's moral authority. If they keep giving in to UNRWA, and if they keep keeping it alive, as the title says, then we have lost all of our authority. But Daniel, what else do you think?
Yeah, and I mean the most important aspects, you always need to keep in mind that, words have meaning, words matter, and words should be used in a certain way. And when people say, and I made this point a couple of times, when people say genocide, what you imply, what immediately, blinks in your mind is 6 million Jews. You think of Holocaust. When someone says genocide, that's what you think of. Concentration camps, and all that. And when you say that about Israel, that Israel is committing genocide, and not only now, you said that even before October 7, it's the open air prison, it's an apartheid state that's doing genocide. I mean, you completely like desanitize any meaning of that war. I mean, something that I've heard recently when talking about famine, because before I researched it more and before we talked about, I was inclined to maybe even saying that there could be a famine in Gaza, and I don't think it would be on Israel's responsibility to fix it. It's on Hamas to take care of its citizens. But you had million people completely uprooted from the north, and so I could find a case that there could be a famine, but again, it would be on Hamas. But what was said before October 7th, it was always said th there is a famine. We saw the articles. There's a water crisis. Gaza unlivable by 2020. There's gonna be famine. Million people are going to die by or what was it? I think it was like by July. Hundreds of thousands of people will be in like the worst like phase of famine. I mean, when you make these statements. And again, that's maybe talking more to the Palestinian side. When you make these statements, you completely take any sort of, like these words again stop having any meaning, and people will be completely desensitized to any sort of arguments like that. So again, as you mentioned, British government already sort of admitted to Israel being apartheid state, and if this thing goes through. It will basically agree that Israel is committing genocide. I mean, yeah, what? How can you redeem yourself after, after going through that?
A lot of people's fears about the coming election in Britain as well is that if Labour get in, and so these are from the Conservative voter side, are that, if Labour gets in, they're going to do so much wrong. They're going to really, leap into the fire willingly, eagerly. And we're going to be just, again, a kind of the poor man of Europe, a kind of quasi-banana republic on our small island. And what are we going to be worth anymore? Now, I understand why people think that. I don't think Keir Starmer will be quite as bad as people are making out, as he might be, as the Labour Party might be if it were led by Jeremy Corbyn. But I can understand some of that concern. However, I would just like to say to them, what have the Conservatives done in the last 14 years on any issue, on a wide range of issues, but particularly here in Israel, that would lead you to think that they're much better, that they haven't completely run out of steam, imagination, and guts? Because for the West to hold out on funding UNRWA, it is going to take some courage because all of these attacks are going to be made. And the British government has to be resolute and sure in its case. And what the British government's noises on this have reeked of is uncertainty and of giving ground, just little bits every now and again. And that, again, matches up with the history of what we've seen the Western governments do when the conflict has broken out in Israel. And for them to have completely lost all this courage, I would just want to say to Conservative voters, this is nothing more than motivation by fear at this point. The British government doesn't, the Conservative Party, who are the British government, don't have anything positive to offer you. You're purely supporting them out of fear that Labour will be worse. And you need to make demands of them that we won't put you there again or anymore. If you act like cowards, if you do this stuff, if you don't fight this, then we aren't going to go with you. I have very little regard for a party like Reform UK. I think they're full of charlatans and loonies and fruitcakes and just people who won't be any good in government. But you have to say to them, we will vote en masse for this third party if you do this. Like, how can you do this to our ally when they're so clearly in the right and so clearly need our help because they're being attacked on all sides, literally and in rhetoric? And yeah. So, and also you undermine our own country, not only in its moral authority in betraying an ally, but in its moral authority for admitting that you're complicit in a genocide. Now, I might be getting ahead of myself because the British government hasn't given in yet, but everything that we've seen them do suggests that they could well do that. And that should be a real fear for people in Britain that our Britain, that our government could do anything like that. And the trend is pointing in that way. Daniel, anything else on this?
Yeah, so you asked what has the Conservative Party done for us, and funnily enough, earlier today I was watching a clip from The Darkest Hour, the with Winston Churchill, or with Winston Churchill as a main character, and yeah, listening to his speeches, you know, talking about the Nazis. I mean, imagine if we had someone like that today. Imagine if you know. David Cameron said, we have to negotiate with Hamas, Israel has to negotiate with Hamas, or even in the case of Ukraine, Ukraine has to negotiate with Russia. And you know, hearing that line, you don't negotiate with a tiger when you're headed in its mouth. I mean, hearing that, like, I got, like, again, like, having these sort of politicians, and we've seen that sentiment here and then. I mean, we hear it a little bit with Ilan Levy, who of course was too radical for the Israeli government, or we've seen that with the Czech defense minister, who after you know seeing what happened on October 7th and after hearing the UN response, said Czech Republic should leave the UN. We have no place in that in that organization. So yeah, it would be great to see politicians like that, but I think for that to happen, there need to be a people who would support such candidates. And I think that's what the most problematic in yeah, today's society, that it's not that, you know, politicians are some sort of people completely separated from the people who elect them. It's yeah, it's on us. It's on us to actually demand something from our politicians and expect something from them.
And unfortunately, I'm making my address there to the conservative voters. Whilst I think conservative voters largely are supportive of Israel, and there are notable right-leaning journalists and right-leaning intellectual voices, let's say, who are saying very good things, notably Douglas Murray and the writers for The Spectator and The Telegraph and so on, who have a much better view of this and so on. There's also, unfortunately, a contingent on the right who I think are primed to give in. Who, I mean, even in The Spectator recently, talking about forgiveness and mercy and its importance. And its importance. And the although the direct thing they were talking about there was more the lack of inclination in our society towards forgiveness and mercy, the unmistakable context, particularly from one of them, who had written a different article in the Daily Mail about our lack of mercy towards, goodness, her name's escaping me now, the young girl who lost her citizenship because she went to support ISIS. Anyway, people, we did a TRS extra about that a few weeks ago. The unmistakable implication and context is what's going on in Israel as well. Because what is Israel is being too merciful in its giving aid to the to these people. And for not even being harsher on her in a way, you might even be able to make that case. But if your primary motivation is mercy, which is an anti-justice perspective, then you're completely going to give in. And so, as well, for people who think that the bastion of civilization lies amongst the conservatives and amongst the right, there's even signs there that they're being wobbly. And mercy fundamentally is an anti-justice perspective. Leonard Peikoff wrote about this, as Jonathan brought up in a quote on the show the other day. But if you think about the speech at the end of The Merchant of Venice, which is a great play, but if you think about this, the really good speech rhetorically, where Portia has disguised herself and is giving the speech against Shylock, where she says that the quality of mercy is not strained, it is enthroned in the heart of kings, the scepter is tempered, and so on. And for all of us in our pursuit of justice, we pray for mercy basically because we know we're not good enough. That kind of Christian ethic, which lies really deeply rooted in our culture, if we give into that, and that has a lot of the impetus and the momentum, then we will give up on justice, not only at home, but overseas in support of our ally. And I can't help but feel really dejected if we do follow that kind of thing. Because we lose our confidence, our self-esteem, and our authority in all of these areas. Now, We've only got a couple of minutes left, but I see we've got a super chat from Terrapin for 15 shekels. A bit off topic, but maybe you could consider looking into the AP stroke RJI Photography Award at some point. Disgusting. The
So
Associated
that's
Press, yeah.
Associated Press, and the other thing is the Reynolds Journalism Institute.
Yes, so I did see that briefly, and we mentioned it on the show. I didn't investigate it too much because I was distracted by some of the other topics we were looking at. But yeah, I thought there was something really reprehensible about giving that photo of the year, whatever it won. Just in the way that people's attitudes towards the hostages who have been taken, and the girl who was in the photo who was stripped in her upper body and had just been murdered and was thrown in the back of a truck surrounded by all these people. People's attitude towards the victims of October 7th is disgusting in the lack of sympathy and empathy that's been shown, not only with the posters, which you may have seen the videos of people ripping them down, but just the fact that these were innocent people who were brutally murdered and defiled. And to give that photo this award just stinks of that same attitude. We've only got a few seconds left, but did you have anything else to say, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, just commenting again about the photo. So the girl was Shani Luke, and yeah, I've seen comments on Twitter saying something like, "Well, what? She expected to go into a festival next to a concentration camp, and she expected to get out safe." I mean, you see these sort of comments like all over the place, and yeah, it's truly disgusting to see something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we also have 99 cents from Bonnie. Thank you so much. We're going to wrap up, but guys, if you're in the UK, write to your representatives and say, if the British government doesn't fight this, we aren't going to support you if you have a Conservative MP, because the pressure really needs to be put on them to grow a backbone about this. But okay, we're going to wrap up now. So we've got the reality show Extra starting in a few seconds. For ARC UK members and YouTube channel members, we're going to be talking about free speech in the UK and also generally. I hope you see us there, and we'll see you all tomorrow on The Daily Show and The Reality Show. Bye bye.
Bye.